What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by the world-renowned psychologist, Robin Dunbar, who explains the science of friendship, from the different types of friend and family relationships to just how complicated the business of making and keeping friends can actually be. It's a particularly pertinent episode in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And if you do enjoy it and want to dig a bit deeper into the themes discussed, you can find a link for Robin Dunbar's excellent new book, Friends, in the episode description. But now I'll hand you over to the host, British oceanographer and physicist, Helen Chersky.
Welcome to this Intelligence Squared event this evening. We are going to be talking about friends. How many have we got? How many have we need? How many do we need? And what has not seeing them for a year done to us all? Robin Dunbar is a fantastic person to discuss all of these things with. He is an evolutionary psychologist, the former director of the Institute of Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology in the Department of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University, who go in for very long job titles and department titles. He's known, of course, for the Dunbar number, which is a good approximate number. It's around 150. And that's about how many friends we can cope with in one of our layers of one of the layers of our social network. And his books include How Many Friends Does One Person Need? And Grooming, Gossip and the Evolution of Language, which was described by Malcolm Gladwell as a marvellous work of popular science. And his latest book is right here for those who are looking at the video. So you can see it's called Friends, Understanding the Power of Our Most Important Relationships. So let's get going. So Robin, of course, we're going to be talking mostly about the book, but it is, in the context of the last year, impossible not to discuss the consequences of COVID on our friendships as we're going along. So I just wanted to start at the beginning. Like, how are you doing? How are your friends over the past year? How's your friendship social, your social network evolved over the past 12 months?
I think it's probably stagnated completely, actually. The digital media are actually, you know, not bad really in terms of actually getting to keep up with people. But at the end of the day, there is nothing like being able to stare across the table in a pub and clap somebody around the shoulders. Face-to-face world is best. There's no doubt about it.
I'm sure lots of our audience will agree with you. And has your research influenced the way you've dealt with COVID, or have you just been muddling along like the rest of us?
I don't think I've had time to think about it, actually. Writing too much while I don't get interrupted.
Fair enough. Well, I guess there's a lesson there. You know, friends are great, but uninterrupted writing time is also very precious. Okay, so just to set the scene with a little bit about the big headlines in the book. So we all know that friendships are important intuitively, but you study this. So why is it? Why are friendships so good for us?
Well, actually, they're crucial. It's not just good, I think. They're crucial to us for two very different reasons. One is the effect they have on our health and well-being, not just our physical health, but also our mental health. And they have a huge impact. Just to put a number on it, if you like, it's become increasingly clear, I think, over the last decade, that the one thing that has more effect than anything else your friendly GP wants to throw at you for your psychological health and well-being and your physical health and well-being is simply the number and quality of close friendships you have. it's extraordinary. And in some ways, I guess it's one of those things we've kind of always known about subconsciously, if you like, but nobody's noticed enough to put it into the medical textbooks. So maybe things will change now that we understand this better. But also at the other level, and the reason friendships have evolved and our social networks in general have evolved, is the fact that your friends in effect provide you with important services. And probably the most important of those are your kind of inner core of what I always call shoulders to cry on friends. Typically, that would be a couple of close family members and a couple of close friends, and perhaps an extra one from either side to make it up. But they're the ones that really seem to matter, both for your health and your kind of psychological well-being, but also they're the ones that will drop everything when your world falls apart and you know, come to your aid, which as you go further out down your social network, you know, into sort of eventually acquaintances and people you vaguely know, they become less and less likely to do that. So, you know, we really do depend. And it's not just sort of, you know, when our psychological world falls apart, they give us support, but they're the ones that will kind of step in and help us when we need something physical done, or, you know, loan us some money, or, you know, whatever it might be that we need.
Well, and your perspective on this comes from studying animals initially, right? So how, tell us a little bit about that, and how easy is it to extend the patterns you see in animals to human behaviour?
It's true. I spent the first half of my research career studying animals, primarily monkeys in Africa and to a lesser extent, antelope in Africa and feral goats in Scotland and North Wales, actually. And it's only about sort of halfway through my research career, I sort of started to think seriously about humans and work on humans. But if you study monkeys in particular, or monkeys and apes, I think it's very easy to kind of feel at home, in the sense that these are incredibly sophisticated, socially sophisticated species, as well as very smart species. But their whole world revolves around this very complex social world they live in. I mean, it really is. Field workers often get sort of flagellated by proper scientists for referring to what they see out there as a soap opera. But in one sense, it really is. It's just an everyday kind of soap opera. And the rules of the game are very, very similar. And so the importance of close friendships for providing support and buffering you against the sort of vagaries of the world are just as important for them as for us. So you see exactly the same effects that females, for example, both in baboons and chimpanzees, who have more friends, the individuals they groom a lot with, are healthier, they are more fertile, their offspring are more likely to survive to adulthood, they live longer. And these are exactly what we see in humans. So it's kind of the same ball game. It's just that inevitably it's just a bigger ball game and even more complicated in humans, because, you know, we can manage a bigger social world basically at the end of the day because we've got a much bigger brain and we can be more sophisticated in how we, if you like, think through our social strategies than say, monkeys and apes. But, you know, primates in general, including ourselves, are in a different league in terms of their social world. I hesitate to say this to a physicist, but actually I think the social world is much the most complex thing in the universe, and it's simply because it's so dynamic. I'll accept the internal dynamics of the sun as a close second. But it's the same sense of chaotic, constant motion and sort of molecules and atoms bumping into each other, if you think of other individuals as the equivalent. It is a very complex world that these species live in, and of course we live in, and managing that requires very, very considerable social skills and cognitive skills.
Well, you mentioned... I'm sure that physicists, especially cosmologists, are surprisingly happy to admit actually what they study isn't complicated compared with protein folding, the human brain and social anything. So I don't think anyone's arguing about that. So you mentioned grooming that. So before we get onto the numbers, I just wanted to pick up on the grooming, because I think that's the sort of thing we entirely associate with animals. But you do talk about human grooming in the book. So that, just as an example, tell us how grooming translates into the human world.
Okay, so monkeys and apes basically use grooming to create and maintain their friendships with each other. And some of these species spend an inordinate amount of their time engaged in this activity. So nominally, they're leafing through the fur, picking out bits of debris and stuff like that, and scabs and the like. And so it is providing a hygienic function. But they spend much, much more time than they need to just to do that, especially for the social species. So some of the most social species can spend up to a fifth of their entire day engaged in this activity. It's hugely costly to them. What it does is trigger a very specialized set of neurons that are in the hairy skin. The receptors sit at the base of the hair follicles, as it were. And it, these neurons go straight into the brain and trigger the release of endorphins in the brain. Now, endorphins are opiates. They're chemically related to morphine. That's where the name comes from. Endorphin is a contraction of endogenous morphine, meaning the brain's own morphine. They're part of the pain control system, but like morphine, and in fact, actually, they're 30 times more powerful as an analgesic, weight for weight, than morphine is. They're incredible little molecules. But they create that same kind of sense of relaxation and all's well with the world, and I'm at peace here, that you get from any of the opiate drugs. The only difference is we don't get addicted to them, at least not physiologically, because the body's adapted to them, if you like. Now, that creates this sort of platform off which they can build meaningful friendships, in effect. Now, we use, it turns out, exactly the same behavior, effectively, all the time in our social interactions, particularly with our very more intimate friends and relations. And we've shown you using PET scanning, where you kind of brain scan what's actually happening in somebody's brain at the time, shown that, you know, when people are being sort of stroked gently on the surface of the abdomen and chest, the brain is just going absolutely wild. Now, there's a very specific movement to these specialized neurons only respond to stroking at a very specific speed. It's actually about 2.5 centimeters a second. If you do it too fast, there's no reaction. If you do it too slow, there's no reaction. It has to be round about 2 to 3 centimeters a second, which is exactly the rate at which hand movements brush across the fur in animals, and in which we sort of stroke and do things like hug and so on. Because we don't have so much hair, we've kind of adapted it to just move the skin, because this is a mechanical system, and it's the movement of the fur on embedded in the skin that causes the response. And so we can trigger that by sort of not only stroking people, but hugging them and holding them and cuddling and all these other things which we spend so much of our time doing.
It's quite interesting because, of course, different cultures have very different attitudes towards touching other people, even in pre-COVID times. And there are cultures where it's very normal, and their concept of personal space is very different. And presumably, do we know anything about whether they have more friends or better friends because they actually get to stimulate that?
No, I think the short answer is, it's an illusion that they don't do very much. I mean, I think probably the difference is, I don't know, some cultures are kind of, if you like, more effusive in whom they'll sort of pat on the back and give a hug to or an air kiss to than others. That's probably fair dues. But if you look at the patterns of where people are allowed to touch each other or be touched by somebody, they are very restricted in terms of the relationship. So the closer the relationship, the more of the body is permissible to be touched, as it were. But that pattern of where on the body you're allowed to touch people is pretty universal as far as we can see. I mean, we've sampled people from all over Europe, so the United Kingdom to Russia, east to west, and north to south, from Finland to Italy. And we've sampled people in Japan as well, who supposedly notoriously non-touchy-feely. And the patterns you see is almost exactly the same. There are a few kind of blips here and there that are kind of peculiar to individual cultures. And some are more kind of touchy-feely than others, not surprisingly. You know, the Brits are a bit less touchy-feely and the Italians are a bit more. But the winners on all this, as the most touchy-feely people in Europe, were the Finns, of all people.
Really?
Who always come across as very upright and staid. But, you know, I'm sure it has something to do with all this time spent in saunas, probably. But there we go.
It's interesting as a sort of how much of what we see matters. So the next question that follows on from that as a brief detour from what's in the book is that, of course, many people this year have been, you know, they've lived by themselves, so they may literally not have touched another person for a year, or they, you know, or very, very infrequently. What does that do to you? Is there any evidence on what just not being touched might, in, you know, in a friendly sort of, all of those connections you were talking about, what happens when you don't have that?
I don't think it's very good for you is the short answer, because one of the reason in large part that you get this health benefit, not just the psychological benefit, but the physiological health benefit, is that endorphins, one of the things they seem to do is kind of tune the immune system. They trigger the release of natural killer cells, NK cells, which are part of the kind of white blood cell complex of the immune system, as it were. And natural killer cells target in particular viruses and also cancer cells. So they, you know, they're going around the body cleaning up the stuff that shouldn't be there, basically. So if you're not getting the endorphin hits, this is kind of probably not a good idea. Fortunately, all is not completely lost, because one of the things we've managed to do in the course of our relatively recent evolution is find ways to trigger the endorphin system without physically having to touch somebody. Now, that's a consequence of the fact that grooming type mechanisms of social bonding, because they're so time expensive, and that's partly because the quality of a relationship depends on the time you invest in it. That's true for us and monkeys, but for them it's face-to-face stuff. And grooming is a one-on-one activity, you know, it really is for them and for us. I always challenge people to prove me wrong by going and trying cuddling two people in the back row of the cinema at the same time. And I'll give you 6.5 minutes before one of them walks out through not having enough attention paid.
I'm pretty sure I've seen my sister cuddle six puppies at a time, but it might be a different thing.
That's a different thing. But it's a very, you know, grooming, physical touch is a very intimate activity, which is why, of course, we don't like being touched with strangers. You know, all cultures in our sample around Europe and the Japanese will only allow strangers to touch their hands. That's why we handshake with people, because it's sort of close enough to say I'm being sort of friendly, but distant enough not to be too intimate. It's about as far away as you can get.
And now we've invented a new one, which is the elbows.
Yes, which is, I have to say, is not going to survive. There's no way that's going to work.
Let's just move on, because I'd like to keep moving on just a little bit, because we've barely even scratched the surface so far. Let's get on to the numbers a little bit. So, of course, you know, there's various qualities of friendship. That's what you describe in your book. And there are these numbers that seem to be surprisingly robust. And I think it's important to note this, because I think quite often when numbers are kind of bandied around, especially in social sciences, it tends to be one or two studies and it sort of looked like that number. But these seem to be quite robust numbers. So tell us a little bit about the hierarchical structure and what those numbers are.
Okay, so if you look at how often people talk or engage face-to-face with their friends and extended family, what you find is that you can kind of string everybody out from the person you devote most time to the person you devote least time to. But actually, it's not a sort of simple line of declining contact. It's rather bumpy. And those bumps occur in very specific places, which cause your social network, the sort of collection of friends and extended family you have, to look like a set of ripples on a pond, if you like, where a stone has been thrown. If you think of yourself as the stone, right in the center, you're surrounded by these ripples which go further and further out. And in fact, the analogy is quite good, because the innermost ripples are usually a bit higher and the outermost ripples are sort of getting towards flat as the energy dissipates. So the innermost layer, you know, are the ones you devote most time to. In fact, you devote 40% of your total social effort to that inner core of just five people. And then beyond that, you sort of titrate your time according to the value of the relationships in many ways. And you end up with these quite distinct layers, and the layers count cumulatively. So each layer includes the layer inside it, but they occur at, well, technically 1.5 right in the center, 5, 15, 50, 150, and then they extend beyond that. That 150 is your sort of natural social network, but they extend beyond to 500, 1500, 5000. That's the largest circle we know anything about, and it really seems to differentiate between completely anonymous people, people you've seen before somewhere or you recognize the photo of. So it's probably as much as we can actually cope with. But those layers, we pick them up not only in face-to-face interactions, we pick them up in telephone databases. If you look at how often people phone each other, you can see it in Facebook. If you look at the frequency with which people post to named individuals, we've even picked it up on Twitter. Heaven forfend, I cannot imagine what that means about the social life of the Twitterati. These are the people following Twitter accounts, talking to each other within the Twitter environment, as it were, rather than the Twitter account owners. Pretty much anything you look at, if you look at the structure of organizations, the structure of natural groupings of humans, you see the same layers. They're extremely robust. And I hasten to say that, but for the sake of having a lot of statistical physicists as friends and colleagues, I wouldn't kind of really know about most of these, because, you know, when you're analyzing these huge telephone databases, you know, where you might be dealing with, like, one data set where there's 9 billion phone calls over the period of a year, or Facebook sized data sets, you know, you need the technical and mathematical skills of statistical physicists really to do it. So thanks be to physics. They have a very important role in my life.
You're being very complimentary to physics this evening, and I'm sure it's absolutely nothing to do with my job. So on the topic, so one of the things we talk about in the book is that, you know, as groups get bigger, it becomes, you know, as tribes, perhaps a natural, you know, all the people who live in one place get bigger, that they actually start to split. So you can't just have a group that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually it'll split into two groups. And even you say, you know, around the dinner table, if you have eight people, it tends to split into two groups. And I was just curious about, there's a lot of, you know, especially at the moment, there's a lot of what feels like tribalism to me in society. There's a lot of us and them. You're our lot or you're their lot. And a lot of people, and I have to confess I'm one of them, wouldn't it be nice if everyone just stopped being in a tribe and just all got on? Is my nice little idea of everyone just not belonging to a very strong bonded social group and just, you know, accepting people, is that a pipe dream? Are we sort of, you know, programmed that there has to be an us and a them at some point? Because if you've got people in your social group, by definition, there are people who are outside it.
Sure. The answer is, I think we're going to have to find a solution of that kind if we're all going to keep going. The problem really goes back to the fact that the way our psychology is designed is for very, very small scale societies. So this is the societies we've lived in for the last probably at least 2 million years in terms of these large scale, relatively large scale by primate standards, let's say, societies. The way historically we've seemed to have sort of handled that is really by setting up us versus them effects. And that's possibly because a lot of the drivers from an evolutionary point of view for having social groups is really predation and raiding. So primates in general, the reason they live in groups is to prevent them, you know, keep predators away, basically. But humans, and to some extent chimpanzees as well, but also, you know, the other primates to a rather lesser extent probably, face this problem of raiding by neighboring groups, whoever coming and nicking your beautiful apples off your apple tree, as it were. So, you know, those groups have essentially been protection against outside threats, and therefore they've kind of inbuilt into them as this us and them thing. Now, that said, come 8 or 10,000 years ago, these hunter-gatherer groups who normally live scattered around the environment, decided it would be a very good idea to settle in villages and things like that. This is the Neolithic Revolution, when we discovered agriculture and how to build stone houses and all these kind of things. The problem with that is you then had everybody crowded together, and particularly once villages became towns and you perhaps had several thousand people living together. It's a sort of generic mammalian problem. Well, birds probably suffer from it too. You know, you keep bumping into people all the time and it just gets irritating. So, you know, little sort of fights develop and things like that. So you have to have some mechanism to hold the lid on that, or people had to find some mechanism to hold the lid on that. And what seems to have happened in the Neolithic, so we're only talking about the last 8 or 10,000 years at most. This is history, basically. This is not sort of evolution in the longer term. This is just history. Is we've found ways of sort of solving that problem. And what that solution has come down to is using some of the mechanisms we use for building friendships to create mega groups. So we create friendships partly, obviously, through all this grooming stuff, but we also do it at a cognitive level, a psychological level, whereby we look for people who are rather similar to us, the so-called homophily effect, which is why we get these echo chamber effects. And we tend to like people and want to spend most time with people who are similar to us, and a whole tranche of, in particular, cultural dimensions, which we call the seven pillars of friendship. And these are things like shared interests and, you know, shared moral views and shared sense of humor, shared musical tastes, and so on and so forth. And it turns out that we're very good at building kind of mega communities out of one single dimension. So normally, with your nearest and dearest, you'd perhaps share six or seven of these seven pillars with them. So if you like to think of them as sort of a supermarket barcode of your kind of interests in life and so on your forehead, or except that you speak them, obviously. But, you know, sort of when you get down to the nether regions of your social network, you might only share one or two. But being able to take one of those as the basis for creating friendships with, what amount of friendships with strangers, seems to be a skill that we've managed to develop quite effectively.
So this is the thing where, you know, if someone supports the same football team or they play the same sport, or it's that sort of thing, that is enough, that we're already sort of automatically on the same side. We've got a shortcut. Yep.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. It's a shortcut through having to get to know them better. Paradoxically, though, the one thing that seems to be particularly good at sort of creating a sense of bondedness with a complete stranger is your musical tastes. If they like the same music as you, boy, you're onto something good here. So
I'm rather worried now. I'm going to go around and check around all my close friends to see if they share. I don't actually know for some of them whether they share my taste in music. But just before we get to the questions, I've got one other question for you, Robin, which is about the effect of gender. So you talk quite a lot later in the book about gender in the, you know, friendships in the context of gender, both romantic relationships and platonic friendships. I have to say, you don't seem to have a lot of truck with the difference between nurture and nature, the effect of nurture and nature on these friendships. You fall quite heavily on the nature side of why men and women might behave in these ways. I was very curious about that. How much does nurture have a role in these friendships? Like, you know, the gender relationships, what evidence is there that the, you know, these gendered behaviours, these, I mean, they're stereotypes almost in our society. How much is it a learned behaviour and how much is it innate?
I think you have to, I mean, there is no such thing as anything that's wholly innate and wholly learned in the biological world. You know, the biological world is a very intricate interaction between these two components, as it were. That said, of course, the proportions are going to vary, and they'll vary for different things. I mean, there are some things over which we have no environmental control at all. And that, for example, is the classic one would be the color of your eyes. You either have the gene for blue eyes or you have the gene for brown eyes. And effectively, that's that. The more social it gets, the more scope there is for learning, and the more important learning actually is. So, you know, this very complex social world in which we live simply couldn't be regulated by wholly genetically determined behavior. It's far too complex and dynamic. It's just constantly changing. So we have to learn those skills, and it takes us probably 25 years, the first 25 years of life, to really learn the skills for handling the social world to adult standards, if you like. Now, that said, that learning is operating on a kind of template which is set up by the genes, and that's where these differences between the two sexes come into play. They really have much to do with the style and nature of friendships. Women's friendships seem to be much more intimate. And this is not just my work that we've come up against this. You know, most of the people that work on friendship just hit their heads straight into it the moment they start observing friendship, really. You also see exactly the same differences between the sexes in all the higher primates, the monkeys and the apes. It seems to be very, very deeply embedded. But the difference is kind of in the kind of intensity of relationships. So at some level, women have much more intense relationships than men do. Men's friendships seem to be rather casual. And this affects the structure of their social networks in quite important ways. And a lot of those components you can track right the way through life. You can right the way from age 5 to age 85. You see exactly the same patterns in who people are friends with. It just doesn't change. So, you know, the it's not so much that there is a kind of enormous rift, as it were, but the kind of fundamental underpinnings, the template on which the social world is based, is partitioned quite radically in these two ways. And that's primarily because the two sexes have different reproductive objectives. That's in evolutionary terms, that's really what it comes down to. And you can see that being played out all the way through the mammals and the birds and practically everybody else as well.
Well, let's move on to some questions from the audience who have been very active. We've got lots of questions, but audience, keep asking your questions. So just to pick up on that last point or to follow on from it, there's one here. Do you think society values romantic relationships more than friendships? And perhaps by implication, should it?
I think the answer is they're both necessary and they're very different. I mean, they do different jobs, if you like, in the generality of our biology, but also they are underpinned by somewhat different psychologies and motivations, which create these much more intense romantic relationships. And clearly, you know, sex is a major component of that, because sex is very bonding. So, aside from its obvious reproductive function, sex itself triggers a lot of the endorphin systems, as well as other neuropeptides in the brain, which create these very, very intense bonds. I don't think there's anything that comes close to that short of the mother-baby relationship. And that really does seem to be in a different league to the father-baby relationship. It's much, much more intense and intimate.
I think there is evidence on that changing recently, right? I definitely see, all these dads who are suddenly able to stay at home are finding that they can have a different relationship with their children.
They can, but it's not the same quality of relationship. I mean, it really is very different. And I think the problem is, the two sexes do not know what it's actually like to be the other sex. It's actually quite, it doesn't very often happen, if you like, that you can actually get inside other people's minds. Hard enough getting inside, the mind of somebody who's sort of in your little cluster, as it were, never mind getting inside the mind of the two sexes. But the key really is how romantic relationships differ from close friendships. Now, you get a phenomenon in women in general called a best friend forever, which in many ways parallels that kind of intense intimacy, but without the sexual component to it. And there is no strong evidence to suggest that that happens in men. You can ask a bloke, do you have a best friend? He'll go, oh, yeah, it's Pete. But if Pete moves away, it's out of sight, out of mind most of the time. Well, one day if I'm up there, I'll drop in and say hello. what he'll do is simply find somebody else to go and do whatever the activity that he used to do with Pete. And this is because the underpinnings of how relationships are built are different between the two sexes. It really does depend crucially on conversation in women, whereas conversation has zero effect, absolutely zero effect, on the quality and the future stability of men's relationships. What's important is doing stuff together, is doing an activity. It's much more activity-based, as it were, in the case of men. Conversation-based in women.
I'm sure there'll be more questions on that. But in the meantime, just picking up on the point you said there, actually, about the mother-baby or father-baby relationship, can or should parents and children be friends with each other? That's next on our question list. It sounds like a loaded question to me, but do your best.
That's the $64,000 question that's been asked since time immemorial, I should say. The answer is, of course, they can do. And sometimes they are. I mean, you often hear somebody saying, you know, my mum or maybe my dad is my best friend. And that's perfectly feasible because you can have a particularly close relationship with a parent or an offspring, and they can be in your kind of inner core of five. But they're no more likely to be best friends, I think, than any kind of other random person that you might spend time with, in the sense that their position on the seven pillars of friendship may actually be somewhat different to yours, and therefore you don't always hit it off with them. And one of the paradoxes that we found in our research is that people are surprisingly often likely to have catastrophic breakdowns of relationships with close family members, parents with offspring with their siblings, which is kind of worrying in a way, because, you know, these are the one group of people who are going to drop everything to come to your aid in time of need. You know, I mean, they are the cavalry that are going to come over the hill. Nobody else is going to be willing to put themselves out. So, you know, you really don't want not to have a reasonable working relationship with them, a reasonable friendship, as it were, because the cost to you in the long run is going to be very high. And yet,
that actually takes us to the next question very nicely. Sorry to interrupt. We've got a lot of questions, but audience keep asking. So the next question for you is, why do friendships end?
Yes. Usually it's a breakdown of trust. And here is the problem with close relationships, both very close friendships, romantic relationships, and very close family relationships. Because what seems to happen is we trade on the relationship rather a lot after a while. We sort of expect them to do things. So, and that's because we're very forgiving of those relationships. You know, so, you know, if I stand you up having invited you out for a drink, if and when we can ever get to the pubs again, you know, you probably just go, oh, for goodness sakes, I'm not even going to contact him again. You know, it's not worth it. And the cost to you is small. With close family relationships, we tend to be much more forgiving and say, oh, well, never mind, you know, we'll find another time. Now, the problem is, if those little breaches of trust keep happening, it builds up and builds up and builds up to the point where it just collapses catastrophically. And those relationships breakdowns are extremely difficult to repair. This is where you get deathbed reconciliations, the last opportunity, as it were. And it seems to happen surprisingly often. So in the end, it's all about sort of people just trading too much on the generosity of the partner. Things like, what becomes important is things like stealing money or you know, taking things from a family member or a friend that they value, and those, primarily those kinds of things, which are, you know, major breaches of trust in effect.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
So next up, Robin, possibly especially relevant this year, are there any substitutes for physical touch in these in building friendships, and are there other possibilities? Can we replace physical touch?
Well, now this is where we get into how we've managed to get over the limitations of grooming, because grooming, as I was explaining earlier, being so intimate, places a really tight limit on the number of people you can go round grooming with. And that limit is at about 50 in monkeys and apes, and it probably is for about us too. And at, while our ancestors were trying to push our community sizes up towards the 150-ish that we have now, in order to break through that glass ceiling at 50, they had to find other ways to trigger the bonding system that didn't involve physical touch. And really what it boiled down to is being able to groom virtually with several individuals simultaneously. Now, the way we've done that in successively seems to have been to exploit laughter, which is extremely good at triggering the endorphin system, singing and dancing. The rituals of religion are extremely good, although they often involve things like singing and dancing and so on. Eating socially together, so the actual consumption of food, and particularly spicy foods, trigger the endorphin system. Drinking alcohol together or perhaps other kind of spicy drinks such as coffee, you know, which sort of give you a hit. We probably get an endorphin hit out of that. Telling emotionally charged stories. All these things are part of the everyday toolkit of conversation, if you like, and everyday relationships. And they all trigger the endorphin system. They all bond people. So we've had people watch a sort of extremely tragic film, you know, almost Shakespearean tragedy film, and measured both their endorphin release as a consequence of watching this film and their bonding to an audience of strangers. And you can just see their increase in the sense of fellow feeling that they have with the other people they do it with. So we can do all these things without having to touch people. And of course, we do them, you know, every day in our normal relationships. And conveniently, we can do quite a lot of these online, at least to some extent.
I was just going to say, you've basically listed all the things we're not allowed to do. No social eating, no dancing together, specifically no singing. You can basically go down the list. And
yes,
this
yes.
is like everything is a big no
yes.
this year.
This is why I said at the beginning that, you know, lockdown wasn't very good for you. But there, you know, we don't have a choice. I mean, that's how life is, as they say at the moment. But the point is that most of those you can kind of have a go at online. I grant you that dancing probably doesn't work on Zoom. But, you know, if you've got a good person, you know, a sort of Gareth Malone, you know, that probably works better than anything else. And of course, that's what a lot of choirs have done. They've just gone and done it all on Zoom. They get the same cake. You can have sort of people have meals together, obviously, and they'll have a drink together on Zoom. I'm still kind of not 100% convinced that it's as good as being able to sit across the table and stare into the whites of somebody's eyes to do it.
I was completely mystified by that. I did not understand when everyone's like, oh, we'll have dinner together on Zoom. It's like, why not just have a chat? Have your dinner yes. beforehand and then have a chat. But perhaps in this context, maybe there is some sense to it.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it sort of works, but I just don't think it works in the same league as being able to, you know, reach across the table and pat somebody on
share.
The shoulder.
You can't share.
That's
can
right.
You?
And you can't yeah. share, you know, the sort of the platters, as it were.
Well, let's move on. So we've got another question here from Albert. So this is a good one. And you do address it in the book. Albert wants to know about the correlation between age and the ability to form friendships. And what, you know, why is there a connection between age and new friendships? And he also, I assume it's he, says at the end, I've personally found there to be a negative correlation, which is diplomatic, I guess.
Yes, well, this is getting very close to home.
So what happens as we age? Go on.
Yes. So actually, you can think of this really as a sort of arc. That you start out at birth, and it's an arc which involves these circles. So we do seem to acquire the circles of friendship as complete circles, as it were, over time, and correspondingly we lose them as we age. But the arc looks something like this. You start out with as that inner core of about 1.5, we're obviously your parents, as it were. By about 5, you can sort of breach the 5 threshold. And then as you age, you can sort of accrete the various layers as your social and cognitive skills are developing and you can handle them. Then what seems to happen is in the late teenage, early 20s, you kind of overshoot, as it were. They commonly get up to about, in terms of face-to-face and meaningful friendships, round about 200, 250 people. And then it's sort of by the 30s, it will cut down and drop to about 150, which is the sort of, obviously, there's individuals vary around these numbers, but these are the average numbers. From about the 30s through to perhaps the late 60s, it's very stable at about 150. And then you go into this sort of period of terminal, I'm afraid, decline from perhaps 65, 70 onwards, where you gradually lose the layers and end up, if you live long enough, back at 1.5 again. Now, that's a consequence at that end of losing people in your sort of layers dying or maybe even moving away or becoming unavailable for other reasons. And if you were in your 20-somethings or teenager, if somebody moved away like that, you would simply replace them with somebody else. You would go to the usual venues that where you meet people and you would find somebody else to add in and replace the missing person. I think what happens when you get to, or at least the general sense in the literature, is because we've only done a small amount on this aspect of it, once you get to the older age, you just no longer have the motivation and the energy to get up and go to places where you're going to meet new people to fill it. And also, you're kind of not sure what people talk about anymore, you know, sort of if they're younger than you or complete strangers. You've sort of built up this cozy little world, which has been very stable in the latter decades of your life. And you're kind of embedded so much within that, you're probably less well engaged with the wider community than you would be when you're younger. So you kind of don't, you're not sure about going to, you know, clubs or whatever, where you would sort of stick out like a sore thumb anyway, and be, you don't know how to ask, invite a conversation. What kind of conversation do you have? What do you want to talk about?
So it's so not necessarily that you can't form friendships. It's more that, just, there are fewer opportunities, yeah, and you're possibly a bit fussier about. I mean, that's anecdotal entirely, but I think people spot what they want in a friend quite quickly when they're older.
Well, I think this is what happens in this sort of overshoot in the late teens, early 20s, is that we kind of look at it as younger people being careful shoppers. You know, they're checking around all the supermarkets to see what's available out there in terms of the possibilities for finding good friends and romantic partners and all that kind of thing. And that, you know, once they've had a look at what the market looks like, then they start to narrow down in their 30s. Of course, the other big thing that rather forces this narrowing down is if you reproduce, and as all those who have young children will remember, you know, babies and social life on the whole
not compatible,
utterly incompatible, and it takes a long time to emerge from it.
Let's move on to a question that follows on, which is an interesting one. So there's no name attached to it, but if men's friendships are largely activity based and women's friendships are largely conversation based, can men and women truly be friends if the differences are so stark? And I have to say here that some of my best friends are male, and mm-hmm. I've never noticed that, but maybe that's obviously one small data point. So how does this work? If the friendships work in different ways, how can they be friends?
A lot of that will depend on the particular personalities and psychological styles of the individuals concerned. So, you know, obviously, you know, men and women are not two completely different kinds. They overlap an enormous amount. So it's a bit like stature. On average, men are taller than women, but, you know, not all men are taller than all women by a long way. So it's the same with all these personality things. Now, it's personality kind of and the seven pillars and these other things which tend to be important. So one area where that's reflected is in Women's Best Friends Forever. About 80, certainly in our sample anyway, 85% of Women's Best Friends Forever will be another woman, right? It's the best girlfriend. But about 15% will be male. And as far as we know, they kind of work all right. There is another aspect to this, and this comes back to the greater social skills and cognitive social skills of women. And it's reflected very nicely in what happens in conversations. So if you look, and again, you know, this is stuff from social linguists from the 70s and 80s when they worked all this out. If you look at men's and women's conversations, they are completely different in the way they're structured. So women's conversations have a lot of what are called back channels. Uh-huhs, oh yeses, I know what you mean. And what women will very often do is finish the sentence with the speaker. So the last clause, we actually did it earlier this evening. I know what you're going to say, and I say it with you. And that's kind of very reinforcing. And so you have this kind of collaborative, communal sort of aspect to it. You never find either of these in men's conversations. They're extremely rare. And in general, men regard back channel comments and finishing the sentence together is rude and intrusive, and they don't like it. So then the question is,
I'm going to start asking them now.
If you've got two different conversational styles, how on earth do men and women get together? So we were puzzled by this, so we went out and watched and listened to what happened to natural couples sitting in cafes and places. And it's very, very obvious is what the women do is adapt their conversational style to the men. The men just carry on. I'm afraid to say, I mean, it's a terrible reflection on men, but that's how it actually works. And that's why you know, all these relationships between the sexes work as well as they do, because women are much more skilled at it. And also they seem to be much more focused on what it is they want to do. So they seem to make a decision much earlier than men do about a prospective romantic partner. You see this in phone calls, databases. It's really quite stark there. They will be just calling and calling and calling, and you know, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. And eventually the guy wakes up and goes, oh, really? and it all takes off. But it's the kind of, I mean, this is all back to the kind of difference in social style that you seem to have between men and women on average, as it were. But it's not to say that around the edges, of course, you've got men who are more feminized in that sense, or women who are more masculinized in their social styles. You know, and to some extent, you know, those where they meet will probably make it a lot easier.
Well, there's a question, you know, here that follows on, and actually it does come right back to the heart of the nature versus nurture thing, I think, and in a really interesting way, which is, it says, there's no name on this one, but some people, maybe men, it says, seem to need fewer close friends than women, as you said, but have more extensive, more transactional professional networks, perhaps supported by platforms like LinkedIn. So what is the difference when it comes to these connections between professional connections, where men are, you know, can be very effective networkers, and they're absolutely, you know, they're on top of that in a way that perhaps they're not in their own social lives? What, because this is that's a very transactional thing. So how does that work, professional versus personal networks?
I think it goes back to the same difference. And I think people are puzzled about why you should have these differences in social styles, as well, and differences in the way the networks are structured. I mean, they have the same basic format. You can see the layers. But in the details, men's and women's networks are quite different. And what it seems to go back to is that men live in a much more clubby sort of world. I wouldn't use the word gang here. I think it's much more clubby in its atmosphere, whereas women have much more dyadic, focused relationships and friendships.
And by that you mean one person to another person?
In an intimacy sense, yes. And that's partly because conversations in the end work better between two people. You cannot hold a conversation with more than four people at a time. There's an absolute upper limit on the size of conversation groups. If it gets bigger than if a fifth person joins, you know, within a minute it'll be two conversations. This is so like clockwork, it's amazing. You can see it happening before you if you know in a pub, or, well, pubs are a bit noisy usually, but you know, in a reception or something like that, you can just see this effect happening. So you can't have more than four people in a conversation, and probably most will be just two people or maybe three people. So women are kind of much more based around these kind of short term, in the sense of through the course of an evening, one-to-one kind of interactions, whereas guys will sort of, some of them may hold forth, I say no more.
Oh, really? I hadn't noticed at all.
No, exactly.
Some of them will hold forth to people like me on the subject of my own expertise. It's fascinating. Anyway, so final question before we run out of time here. So you mentioned the seven pillars of friendship, these things like shared values and shared interests and that kind of thing, which can bind people together. Is there a hierarchy? And if there does it depend on your culture?
No, because at least at one level, the seven pillars of friendship seem to be what economists would call substitutable. In other words, a three-pillar friendship can have any three pillars, and it will be just as good as a three-pillar friendship with a completely different set of three pillars. Because what these are really is about shared culture, primarily. So it's you know, one of the pillars is speaking the same language, preferably speaking the same dialect. And the moment you open your mouth, a native speaker of a language knows exactly where you came from, right? And in the 70s, the social linguist told us you can place a person's birthplace to within 25 miles, roughly,
I have had personal experience of that, actually. I once sat down at dinner when I was at university at Cambridge, and the guy opposite me didn't speak for all of the starter, and he looked up and he said the name of the town that I was born in from my accent. I was really impressed.
No, anyway, it's right.
And so, I believe that.
I'm told by, I wondered if it was just an English thing because, we have so many regional dialects. But I was told by French and German colleagues that no, you could do it there just as easily too. So I think it's just, it's the size of the language group that we live in just marks you out. And it marks you out as, I know where you're from, you're one of mine, or you're not. I don't have to know more than that. But so do most of the pillars. They're things we are socialized into. It's what we learn, as teenagers primarily. It is to be a member of that community, that's how we do things, and the right way to behave, and the kinds of things that are interesting. Of course, these change over the course of a lifetime as you, have opportunities to experience new things. But nonetheless, it's still the case that the dimensions tie you down sort of to a particular small scale community.
Well, we are out of time. So everyone, our particular little community we formed this evening virtually that you and I never got to see, but they got to see us, I guess, probably doesn't count because there was no shared eating or feasting or dancing. But anyway, so to the audience who joined us virtually, thank you very much. Thank you, of course, to Robin for joining us this evening and to Intelligence Squared.